This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh on his exposé regarding an aspect of the war in Ukraine.
It's clear that the United States blew up the pipeline between Russia and Germany. This will have tremendous effects, and it has not been reported by the mainstream media. In one of its first moves, the newly elected Republican House of Representatives spent days fashioning a resolution condemning socialism.
We have on Jeff Mackler, a socialist activist, to expose the real agenda behind the passage of the resolution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The war in Ukraine is illegal. It's a violation of international law. Peace forces in the United States are demanding a ceasefire and negotiations and the recognition of Russia's legitimate security concerns, sure. And of course, at the same time, we recognize that the Russians were provoked by the U.S. and NATO into invading Ukraine, having, placed so many military bases and bombs on Russia's border. The latest development of enormous economic and political consequences, though, is the American blowing up of the two pipelines that provided cheap Russian natural gas to Europe. The great investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has recently discovered and published a hugely significant investigative article on Substack proving that the United States, despite its vehement denials, was in fact responsible for the blowing up of those two pipelines. This was done to prevent the integration of Russia into the European economy, because now the United States and Norway sell liquefied natural gas and plain old natural gas to Western Europe at four or five times the price of Russian gas. Well, we speak today with the wonderful journalist Seymour Hersh. In the past, Hersh's important articles were published in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and such, but not now. His article on the U.S. blowing up of the two pipelines had to be self-published on his Substack platform. Seymour Hersh, of course, has won a Pulitzer Prize and five Polk Awards, beginning with his expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where American troops killed 500 women, children, and old men. Well, Cy Hersh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm so happy to be on Law and Disorder.
Cy, first question, obviously, how did you uncover the truth? How did you discover that the U.S. was responsible for blowing up those two Nord Stream pipelines? After all, the Biden administration had vehemently denied it, blamed the Russians and what have you. How did you get to the truth here?
Well, it's not so much of what made me think about it. I have a wonderful friend. He was a Middle Eastern born in Syria, but ran out of the country. Anyway, ended up becoming a multi-zillionaire in oil. And he's very brilliant. Just lives and reads and thinks all day. After I did the story, he called me and he said, "Oh, Cy," he said, "you have become the master of deconstruction of the obvious. Come on, the president said I'm going to do it. Victoria Nuland said one way or another, this is in." What happened is after My Lai, pretty early after My Lai, there were a lot of people that were in that war, you know, went in, you know, young officers and young intelligence people and people in the Phoenix program thinking I'm really going to do something. And what happened to them is they learned very quickly that all the U.S. Army wanted to do was kill gooks. And so there's a lot of disillusionment, but people stayed in. And so then I start doing My Lai. And so that attracts people, because the people I deal with are the people on the inside who want to be on the inside, you know, many family histories, you know, they understand that they're taking the oath of office. Not to their boss, not to the general, not to the president, but to the Constitution. That's what they understand. They really do. And so that's how, by the time I got to the New York Times in early 70s, I was wheeling, you know, and I did a lot of stuff there, all, by the way, with anonymous sources. Anonymous sources are very interesting for newspapers because If they want to run it, nobody cares about the anonymous source. If they don't want to run it, why, it's the fault that it's anonymous. And, you know, and after all those years of writing anonymously about sources, I just, that's just the way it is. It's a different media today. I think Trump did it. He, you know, we now have Fox News and the New York Post, et cetera, versus the New York Times and sometimes the Washington Post. And so you have a different, it's a whole different political structure. In the Vietnam days, the Senate Democrats, with a lot of moderate Republicans, passed the all sorts of legislation. The, you know, the War Powers Act, insisting that the in 1973, that it got us on the road to getting out as much as anything else. And can you imagine Chuck Schumer today saying, "I want an investigation of the Senate"? Not a chance. It's just not going to happen. They're just too polarized. It's they've got a Democratic president, and who frankly scares the hell out of me, but that's okay. And his gaggle, Tony Blinken and Newland and Sullivan, I call them Winken, Blinken, and Nod. They're so alike in their venom and towards all things Russia long before this. And also, we had Tony Blinken point his finger at his Russian counterpart in public with the press watching in China. Mm. You know, I mean, what are they doing? What's their game plan? So anyway, and I will tell you something that I've told other reporters since this story. The people in the pipeline business, some of them are Americans who own companies that build pipelines. The pipelines were, the first legislation about underwater pipe materials goes back to 1884 when the telegraph. And there was a international agreement we signed then if you inadvertently with a boat or something cut into a line, you're liable for damages, et cetera. It was updated, and we signed it again in 1898 or 99. Since then, there's been no specific legislation about a pipeline, although it's clear, I did a lot of law review looking at this, it's clear you can sanction, you can get economic sanction, but it's not clear where criminality comes in. They're trying to get the people in the LOC, law of the sea business, are trying to get it rewritten, the codes, to include pipelines. There's 12,000 pipelines. But the people who build pipelines and finance pipelines were involved in the actual work of getting... there were two pipelines, Nord Stream 1, which was owned by Gazprom, and there's also another one, Nord Stream 2. The first one came online in 2011, and the new one was sanctioned by the Germans, and the Germans stopped it because under American pressure. It was built, finished in 2021. Anyway... the people in the business absolutely are convinced. That doesn't mean they know, but from early on, only people were Washington. That's what they were saying. But that's not credible. So in October, while talking about something else, a month after the incident happened, I was dealing with something else with somebody I have people I've been dealing with forever, and I asked about it, and that started about 3 months of a lot of work to figure out everything, and I eventually got to Norway, and then I learned, as I wrote just the other day, that Norwegians were involved in a lot of the dirty stuff we were doing in North Vietnam, that pushed that Johnson finally got a chance to tell a lie and get us into the Gulf of Tonkin, and with a lie, it got us into a war that killed, we usually say, between 2 and 3 million Vietnamese. And 58,000 American guys with who knows how many coming out with injuries and severe mental problems off the war. I saw this pipeline as potentially a game changer because I don't think there's any question that Biden had an option from January on. He pulled the trigger in late September when it was very clear on the inside, even though you don't read this in the Times and Post federally, that at best you're going to get a very bitter, murderous stalemate, and probably not. And so winter was coming, and he was very worried that the pipeline Nord Stream 1 had already been shut down by Putin in anger at the rhetoric from Washington. And Nord Stream 2 was, as I say, controlled by the German government, and Biden's issue was, would Scholz, and you know, it's a very mercantile society, the Germans have been riding high on cheap natural gas. They actually had enough so they retailed some of it themselves, and the Russians and the Gazprom and the companies that own Gazprom didn't mind that. And here comes another one online, which was going to be a boon. They're going to have gas forever. And I think, my heuristic thought is that, I've been told this, but that doesn't, people telling me with this kind of stuff, nobody knows what the president's mind. He decided he had to prevent the Germans with fall coming, and maybe it wasn't a bad winter, but he had to prevent them from defecting from his war and backing off, and NATO backing off in Western Europe, because it wasn't as popular as you think. You know, we were putting tons of money in, and the Germans certainly didn't want to put more in. And he was afraid they would just release the sanctions. The chancellor was in charge, and start using Russian gas. In other words, what they described it as Blinken later described it after the blow up, about 4 days afterwards, he said, or 5 days afterwards, he said in a speech that no more can Russia weaponize gas. And that notion of Russia and with its natural resources weaponizing their influence in the Western Europe goes back to the Kennedy days. Really, about the idea, always worried about, this is the whole containment madness. Saigon falls in May, April, when all those horrible pictures, 75, to the dirty communists. Cambodia fell to a faction that was largely communist. Vientiane, that was about 2 days, 2 weeks later. I should have these dates better in mind. Vientiane and Laos fell eventually, became more or less communist controlled. So the whole containment notion that led us into this war, this is the whole reason we were fighting the war, to contain Red China, communist China, from controlling it all, and all went down. And guess what happened? Nothing. You know, we're the largest trader of Vietnam, with Vietnam right now. Their largest trading partner is us. All that stuff made me think the only person had a reason to do it. So when I began to ask questions, the answers came very quickly. Well, of course we did. And I'll tell you one more thing. The power of the president is enormous. He can test the intelligence community. He can go to this new Office of National Intelligence, and that's the most, they're the super lords of the intelligence community. And their intelligence, the guy that runs the direction of the intelligence office for the ONI, that's the one number one office. You can go there and test them for an all source, SIGIN, all everything, study of who did it. He can also test the DI, and the CIA. They have operations division. They also have an intelligence, the DI, Directorate of Intelligence. Does a lot of good work, a lot of assets. He could test them. For the spooks, for the covert guys, there's another little separate unit. I think they used to call it the C, an intelligence unit, because you got guys around the world, and you have to be monitoring all the communications around and make sure nobody's onto them. He could have asked, test them, and I will tell you right now, he never asked anybody to give him an example of who did it. You have to be a genius to know why, because he knows who did it. He knows what, there's no reason to ask that question. I mean, it'll come out. It'll just come out.
Cy, by destroying the pipelines, will this seriously affect the economies of Western Europe?
Are you kidding? Let's see. Right now, even though it was a mild winter, that was a big factor. Two things were a big factor this year. One, late September gave, particularly Germany, gave the Germans enough time to buy liquefied natural gas right away from us. At two or three times the price. I wasn't very happy. That was a dumb move by us. But anyway, they did. And because the economy in China, because of COVID, has been very slow, the Chinese sold them a lot of. So they got up to about 73% of what they needed. And that got them through a mild winter. But they have no ability now to do the same for next winter. And that's when the panic is on. It got colder in January, and the complaining from Germany got louder. And I was asked to do, in the last week, go to a conference at the Max Planck Institute, which is sort of the super Harvard of Berlin anyway, Germany. And they're all in a dither about what to do, because the United States, which always, we were the go-to guy for Western Europe. There's no natural products there. They don't have their gas and oil. We were the guy, and we've just told them, I want to keep this crazy losing war in Ukraine going. This corrupt country that couldn't have got into NATO if it stood at its head. And by the way, Russia has yet to commit any of its real army. And all the intelligence people I know, as you're already hearing, I'm sure, if you have friends in it, are much more dire about what's going to happen. It's just going to be a meat grinder for the Russians in the next couple of months. They're going to start an offense soon, and it's going to be pretty bad. And, you know, I don't know what Biden's going to do then. Why is he doing it? Well, presidents always get popular in wars.
I want to say, do you think that what you've been describing will be enough to bring about, in fact, there's been reports in the Washington Post today, the New York Times, about how the coalition, which is held together reasonably well, is beginning to show some strains. And to what extent might what you've been describing have an impact on the political willingness of the German government and people to continue supporting the war in Ukraine? What do you think about that?
One answer is, of course, who gives a hoot about what I think? But I haven't gotten beyond that, because I can tell you that a lot of people from the Bundestag have been calling me, and I stay away from that. I don't talk to anybody in politics. I never testified before a committee. I just didn't want to. I just wanted to stay away from it. And Kohl may have a problem, because the question that both some on the left, the right there is awful, because they're so much against immigration and they're very vicious sort of people. But and by the way, the Green Party, which used to be left, is now sort of a pro-war party. Everything changes. It's so much changed in the last decade in Germany in politics. But Kohl has a problem, because there was a talk that in February this year, by the way, imagine if you're a group of guys, you know, working out of Norway, and Norway has a long history with us of down and dirty tricks, come on, all the way back, particularly in the Vietnam War early on. But and so you're working in Norway, and you're consulting with the pretty interesting guy that's the head of the CIA, he's an interesting guy, because I think he's learning a lot. And so the question is, how much does he want to know? Well, maybe he doesn't want to know that much about what he's doing, but I assure you that the seniors in the White House don't know. I mean, they don't want to know. They want the result. They want to ask questions, but they don't really know much about what's going on. That's just the way it has to be if you're running a really seriously covert operation. You don't, because you worry about talk. And one of the reasons they worry particularly is they eventually told Burns. I think they have respect for him. He came in and he brought his own people on the State Department, INR intelligence. He didn't bring people in from the operations division. And I'll tell you right now, anybody that tries to run that agency without bringing in, you know, the not only the brains of the upper, of the covert side, but also the knuckle draggers, can't make it. They work against them. You know, what can I tell you? I've known that people for 40 years. They're tough. Anyway, but they told the White House in January, we can do it. I mean, we think we know how to do it. We've got the people. The problem was to find the right spot, and the Norwegians knew more about the Baltic Sea. It's 750 miles long, and you can't show up with divers there because there's no oil there. You know, you can't have a bunch of divers going down and digging around. So they told them that. Within 10 days, Victoria Nuland, who in my book is just not as smart as people think she is. Remember that famous conversation? She was overheard, intercepted up in 2014, trying to pick the leader of the new government in Kiev. She's doing a briefing, and somebody mentioned something about Nord Stream 2, and she says, let me tell you, she said, by one way or another, that pipeline's not going to be built. It was in January 20th or something like that. And then 3 weeks later, I think 20 days later, the 7th, by the way, I use New Yorker editors who aren't there anymore, and New Yorker fact checkers, because they're the best, and I have to do that. And on the 7th of February, with Scholz there, Biden, and you can understand Biden maybe thinks he can back down Putin, but by then already they began to move up the hospital corps, the vans with operating rooms, and once that getting to Belarus, you know it's coming. But even so, he had a briefing with Scholz, and he was asked by the reporter, somebody asked him about Nord Stream 2, and he says, that's not going to happen. We're going to stop it. And a reporter said, well, how are you going to do that? Let me tell you, if they go, we know how to do it. These aren't the right words, but the import was the same. We know how to do it. We will do it. And that's a quote that just doesn't exist anymore. That in the subsequent stories that were written by the New York Times and Washington Post about whether, you know, there were stories last fall, who did it and what.
Cy Hirsch, Jim and I want to ask you, why did you self-publish your investigation on Substack? I mean, why did you do that? Why didn't you get it published on a major outlet like the Times? And what has been the impact of your sensational revelation?
Do you notice what the Times and Post, what their politics are? Biden apparently had in Munich, he had a conversation with his counterpart in, in Russia. In Russia. And this morning paper began with, it was briefed to the press, began on the front page, unless it was yesterday's morning, but I think it was just this morning's, had five paragraphs all about how Blinken told him this and told him that and blah, blah, blah. Then Ned Price, the spokesman, he used to be in the CIA. He's just, you know, wind him up and he says what you want. Added to it, I haven't looked at the jump yet, but eventually I think they might get to what the Russians said about that meeting. When I was at the New York Times, you couldn't get away with that stuff. You couldn't get away with some of the language you used about Russia. Well, for no cause whatever, he went in there. The language has changed so much in that paper. And I was in 72. I was just a kid. I did the Mili. I had trouble getting on a newspaper. And I went to see William Shawn of the New Yorker because I always read the New Yorker. And in 5 minutes, he hired me. But the New York Times and Washington Post won't. I don't know what planet they're on. And then I left them to go to the Times because the editor of the Times, A. Rosenthal, told me essentially that they were screwing up the war. And not in the field. You had Halberstam and Homer Biggert, if you remember those names. And David and Neil Sheehan were doing great reporting for the Times from the field. But Washington was, as it always is, you know, looking at their president and the national, you know, their people more. Kissinger was also a big player at the Washington Bureau. But I went there, and I had the halcyon days. Anonymous sources, I could write about anything. Nobody worried about it. Those are different days. I wouldn't go to the Times now because they wouldn't publish me like today. I mean, I see the change in the paper. And one of the things is, when I was there, it was 1.7 circulation. Now, paid paper. Now it's about 310, 320. They don't care about it. I'm a subscriber every morning, but they don't care. They've got 15 or 20 different blogs and podcasts going. That's a thing of interest. I don't quite know what's going on. It's not very objective reporting about the Ukraine war. That doesn't mean you like Russia. You know, who likes what Putin does? He started the first war, the bloodiest war in Europe since World War II. There's been other wars, you know, the Balkans and other, and Chechnya. But you know, this is something else. You know, you can't like him for that. But it's not without some cause. He's got 800 miles from him. He's got American missiles that overnight could be turned in. They're defensive, but they could be turned around. Believe me, I know that. And 8 minute ride to downtown, you know, enough to take out all of Moscow with the power we have. And so he's got some cause. What blowing up the pipelines did in that cause, he's blowing up the pipeline because he hopes he can hold on to European support for Ukraine. Because he knows in September the 26th, that was the day. And I went back to a lot of guys just in the last month and said, you know, there's other intelligence people in the world. You know, I mean, don't get stuck on one thing. There's other people. They're allies of us, but they also have the same intel. Anyway, I mean, I don't want to overdo this. But I'm just telling you, I think we have a real problem with Joe Biden. You know, it doesn't seem that the rhetoric doesn't change. And I'll tell you something else nobody's looked at. If you look at the politics of Russia and 2 years ago, when we began to beat them up verbally when they got in, the chances of Putin getting public support for a war was zero. You know, it would have been 30-40%. And over the 6, 8, 9 months of comments, attacks on him and all that stuff, and that was tit for tat for sure. And the more Putin complained about Putin, the better Putin's polls were. I mean, about Biden, the better it got, it seemed. I'm sure that helped that way. But you could really argue, and I will tell you this, there's been an assessment of this inside, not that they're ever going to release it, that you know, that part of the factor that got him into the position where he thought he could go, 70% of the population supporting him now, was the aggression we did. And yes, there was a terrible mess, what he called, you know, for a draft. Remember that? But again, yes. I'm old enough to remember in 65, 66 when his name was Hershey, General Hershey, began to push the draft. And I can't tell you how many more than the 3,000 people that were prosecuted there were that weren't prosecuted, that simply tore up their thing and left, or left or just ignored it. They thought, you know, they were, you know, it wasn't like a third as it was in Moscow.
Cy, I signed up this morning to read your investigative reporting on Substack, and I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can read that also.
If you go to seymourhirsch.substack.com, it'll open up, and that first story I wrote is there for everybody. And after that, because that's the way it works in the world today, the next two articles were in a paywall, but it's, you know, people, you have to pay $5 or something like that to read it, $5 a month. It isn't about money, believe me. Substack, I knew from a friend of mine, a young colleague who used to be at the Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi. I knew that he had really done very well in Substack in terms of getting out issues, and ran into a lot of trouble by liking Musk. But what he's writing about was the NSA and CIA's ability to manipulate Twitter. And that's a very serious story, and I will tell you that was a very serious operation. That wasn't done by accident. They wanted to get in and begin to manipulate Twitter. You know, every time you got the agency manipulating ostensibly for national security reasons, it always ends up, and Taibbi's been showing this, it gets to be for political purposes too, you know, to always help out the president, whatever. And you know, I'm somebody who wrote about domestic spying in the United States that was not known for 8 years. The CIA could operate for 8 years. You know, don't think they're not competent. My God, this operation they did, you know, there's a bunch of OSINT people, all open source intelligence, saying, well, the boat wasn't there and all that. I'm telling you, the guys running this operation love that OSINT because they could have a Marmara in there, but the signal's coming up and OSINT picking it up. And the plane, they said no plane flew. Three days ago, the president went to... flew from Poland into Kiev, and the stories even wrote how the plane that flew them in disbanded their transponder. Everybody has an idea of a transponder for making sure everybody in the world knows where they are. And all you do is turn it off, folks. I have to deal with. I don't want to educate a bunch of guys about what open source intelligence is because, you know, they're so convinced they're right. They keep on saying the ship I named wasn't there. Well, it was there, but of course you didn't know it because it wasn't using the signal you think it was. You know, I mean, it's so dumb.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Every success with the articles that I know you'll continue to write about this tremendous development, and we're hoping that it'll do something to help end this war. Cy Hirsch, thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, guys. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
February 2nd of this year, the now Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution denouncing the horrors of socialism. It passed overwhelmingly in a 328-86-14 vote. More than half the Democrats voted for it, while 86 voted against and 14 voted present. The resolution is made up of lies and half-truths. We urge listeners to read it for themselves. It's online. The resolution is 3 pages in length, and 99% of it consists of a series of whereas clauses pointing out what the Republican authors of the resolution believe are examples of the horribles of socialism. What is socialism? Socialism has never really existed anywhere, yet there have been attempts, starting with the Great Russian Revolution of 1917, which effectively ended the slaughter of World War I. It was overthrown in 1991 when the USA and others successfully restored capitalism to the Soviet Union. What would a socialist society be like? First of all, it would be democratic, politically and economically, and it would not be run by the 1%. America has a rich history of electing people with a socialist vision. Socialism would eliminate racism and economic want. It would provide for education and health care, housing and employment for everybody. Production would be for human needs, not for profit. It would clean up the environment and eliminate the threat of catastrophic man-made climate change. To counter the false image of socialism propagated by the U.S. Congress, we speak today with Jeff Mackler. Jeff is the National Secretary of Socialist Action and was their candidate for president in 2016 and in 2020. Mr. Mackler also serves as the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, or UNAC. He's the director of the Mobilization of Free Mumia Abu Jamal and a steering committee member of the National Julian Assange Defense Committee. A lifelong activist, Jeff Mackler is the author of 25 books and pamphlets on political, economic, and anti-U.S. imperial war movements. Jeff Mackler, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you.
Jeff, is it fair to say that all the countries, both current and historical, that are mentioned in the House resolution as socialist nations are really not? And if so, then please tell our listeners what you believe a truly socialist nation would look like. On racism, for example, Malcolm X said that he did not believe you could eliminate racism under capitalism any more than a chicken could lay a duck's egg. And then he concluded that if it ever did, it would be a pretty revolutionary chicken. Please talk about racism, democratic rights, free speech, health care, housing, war, peace, employment in a socialist society.
Well, that's a great question. I remember Malcolm also saying when he was asked about black Democrats, his definition was fire on one end and fool on the other. And that is, he was losing confidence in the capacity of the Democrats or Republicans to make any change. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, which is unprecedented probably in history, 25 million people mobilized a couple of years ago, and they marked that this society is replete with systemic racism. And that is, it's not an accident, it's part of the system. Of course, the socialist society understands that racism is central to capitalist functioning, and that is, it needs to divide working people. If they can get away with paying one person less, like a black man or a Latino, it pushes a downward pressure on all wages. But I'm more or less astonished at the nature of the House resolution that you refer to. Here's a resolution written by perhaps the richest core of legislators in the world. I don't think there's a single member of the House who is not a millionaire, if not a multi-millionaire, and they represent the billionaires and the trillionaires who really run the country and elect them in the first place. So I think it's a poor joke that the richest class in the world is decrying an effort by working people to live a decent life.
It's disgusting, of course, what American capitalism has been able to do in terms of distorting what socialism is and distorting even who historically have been socialists in this country. Martin Luther King was essentially a socialist. So was Helen Keller, the famous blind and deaf woman who, despite her disabilities, figured it out. Even Frederick North Olmsted, the designer of Central Park, was a socialist. Socialists have been elected to national, state, citywide offices around the time of World War I. And of course, then the government has been doing all it can to crush them. We have a rich history of socialism, however little the American people may know of that, don't we, Jeff?
You might add Albert Einstein to the list. He was also a socialist that decried the war-making capitalist system. I think that a good picture of socialism, as opposed to the first couple of lines of the House resolution that declares that socialism under Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution was a murderous system that killed millions of people. I think a quick look at that revolution would be revealing. On day one, upon defeating the Tsar in the largest country in the world, the working class organized in councils of workers, peasants, and soldiers in the middle of a war, passed a few decrees. That's on day one, October 1917. What were these decrees? What did these so-called evil socialists do? The first thing they did was they nationalized all the land and gave it to the peasants. That was the largest land reform in the history of the world. Second, they decreed the right of freedom, self-determination, and secession for all of the oppressed nationalities. That's where socialists in the United States get the idea that there should be no racist oppression in the United States, that all people, black, white, Latino, Asian, should be treated equal. Well, that's what the Bolsheviks, who the House resolution decries, did on day one. They gave the right of the conquered nations, of the colonies of the Tsarist Empire, the largest in the world, to secede, to vote, to leave. And some did, like Finland, which was basically a Tsarist-controlled conquered nation. They gave them the right to their language. And they did a few other things. They decreed the right to free medical care, to quality housing, to an end to discrimination based on gender preference. They literally taught classes to working people on gender equality. This is 1917, not 2017 or 2023. The most important thing they did, these horrible Bolsheviks, is they announced that they were leaving World War I. The United States was allied with Tsarist Russia and Japan against the Axis powers, Germany and the Middle Eastern countries, in a war that took the lives of tens of millions of people. And on day one, the Bolsheviks moved to get out of the war. And the simple idea that working people shouldn't kill each other for capitalist profits. And what do I mean by capitalist profits? This was a world war to fight over the distribution of the colonies of imperialism everywhere in the world. If I could tell you an unusual story, when I was a kid, my dad got me a Rand McNally map, one of these 8-foot by 6-foot maps of Africa that he put on my wall in my bedroom. And as I was going to bed, I was probably 13 years old, listening to the Lone Ranger and his Indian companion Tonto fight for law and order in the early West, I looked at the map because I had nothing else to do before I went to sleep. And the map was quite interesting. It had countries like Southwest, French Equatorial Africa, Spanish Guinea, French Equatorial Africa, British Rhodesia, Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, Portuguese Angola, Spanish Sahara. In other words, the entire map of Africa was divided between the colonial powers, and the horror that they imposed on those people was unprecedented in world history. And I'm not exaggerating. It was the first time in that colonial era that capitalism depopulated, reduced the population of an entire continent, with the leader in the horror being King Leopold in Belgium, who slaughtered 12 million people and extracted the rights to the ivory and rubber in that country. I might add one point. The rights to the mineral resources in the Congo at the turn of the century, that is 1902 or 3, went to the Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan Trust, who today run J.P. Morgan Chase, the richest bank in the world. So capitalism has a rather an evil history, whereas socialism, the first example of it, when working people took power democratically through their own organizations, they liberated humanity in a sixth of the land of the planet. giving people the land, the right to control their ideas, the right to plan their economy, the right to grant free, organize for free medical care and health care, the right for divorce, the end to discrimination. That was quite an achievement, whereas the House said that they were butchers that slaughtered 10 million people.
This is Michael Smith. I'm co-hosting Law and Disorder with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking today with Jeff Mackler. Jeff is the head of the Socialist Action Party. Jeff, why do you think the Republicans, as one of their first moves, took the opportunity to denounce socialism? And are we now in a new era of McCarthyism?
I think it's part and parcel of the bipartisan politics of both parties to cut social services to the bone. They've done this, whether it be Clinton in office or any other president in recent era. There's been a massive exchange from the poor to the rich. That is, the rich have socialism like never before. They pay lower taxes than ever before, if they pay taxes at all. And working people have been reduced to a significantly lower standard of living than at any time. So this is just the Republicans' way, propaganda-wise, there's nothing in it that specifies anything, to cut back on Social Security. In fact, one innocent Democrat, or perhaps not so innocent, tried to amend the House resolution saying Social Security and Medicare are not socialist. And that was defeated. It was the Republicans' way of saying, be prepared, we're going to balance the budget by spending more money on the military than ever before, and we're going to try to cut social services and Medicare and public education, health care in every form. Privatizing public services for the profit of the few is the norm for both parties.
Well, and I'm curious because of what you said. The Democrats have made a great show, Biden did at his State of the Union, of speaking up for Social Security and Medicare and calling the Republicans out on it. And the Democrats, as you pointed out, did make that whatever half-hearted effort to put that in the resolution we're talking about. But when it wasn't in the resolution and language was in it that suggested that programs like Social Security should not be part of governance here in the United States, nearly, or at least half of the Democrats nevertheless went along with it. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that we really have one party that represents capitalism. They get elected every 4 years or so by billionaire elections which are run by a tiny handful of people who select the idiots that are in Congress today. They know nothing about what they're doing. And when I say that, it's not an exaggeration. You know, when you had the Republican in the last debate when what's-his-name became the House Speaker, he had a fight with his own party because a minority of the right wing of his party said, we want the right to see the legislation we passed. And when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did the same thing, she suggested, maybe we won't elect Nancy Pelosi until we get an agreement that Biden would sign certain progressive legislation. Ocasio-Cortez said the same thing. She said, we peons in the House of Representatives, we don't write the legislation. We don't see it. It's thousands of pages of tax codes and details. One Republican, innocent or not so innocent, literally said, and I want the right to see the legislation 2 days and a half. And I want to say that all legislation has to be on one subject. That is, as opposed to the idea that every politician slips in their own little piece of legislation, making this or that section of the ruling rich richer than ever before. So the entire legislative process is fraught. As you said, when Biden first came to office, he proposed a $6 trillion, you know, progressive package, which he touted across the country. By the time the debate ended, it was reduced to like $1.3 trillion. They cut $5 trillion in promises to working people in order to balance the budget, in order to fund the military, in order to not tax the rich. So all of Biden's promises, like for example, he said during the Ukraine war, the war prof, we have to stop the war profiteering. The United States spends more money on war than virtually the entire world combined. This country, this so-called democracy, maintains 1,100 military bases in 110 countries around the world, whereas the evil Russians, and believe me, I'm no Putin fan, he's a minor imperialist player, Putin has 6 military bases outside of Russia, and the vicious Chinese, they have 1 military base in Djibouti at the Horn of Africa, as opposed to the United States 1,100. So if you're talking about oppression, colonialism, slaughter, you're talking about the United States. The resolution that the House passed condemns Venezuela and Iran. That's because the United States, once again, is trying to get their oil. They happen to be the 2 richest reserve nations with reserves in oil in the world. So suddenly they want to demonize. And the embargo and the sanctions of Venezuela has, according to United Nations rapporteur, killed 50,000 people. This kind of slaughter, the resolution condemns Cuba. But the Cubans fought against the Batista dictatorship that slaughtered 60,000 people. The resolution condemns Nicaragua. But the Nicaraguans removed the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship that slaughtered 80,000 people before it was taken over by the Nicaraguan masses. The same thing with the Guatemalan dictatorship and the Chilean dictatorship of Pinochet. These are the real horrors of capitalist society.
Jeff Mackler, we're seeing the resurgence of a proto-fascist movement in America. The great German playwright and political figure Bertolt Brecht said that in order to understand fascism, you must look at capitalism from where it springs. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, Brecht was right. He also had a humorous response when he said, if you don't like the working class, you can always get a new one. That is for those cynics who don't have confidence that working people, the vast majority, can build society in their own interests. That's what socialism is all about. It's about building majority rule. But Brecht was right. Every serious person who analyzes history understood that Hitler's fascism, Hitler's Germany, his rhetoric notwithstanding, and he was a rhetorician to say the least, he called his party the National Socialist Party, but the origins of all fascist regimes are capitalism. It's a capitalism where the ruling class loses confidence in the masses and can't resort to the typical, quote, democratic rule that we have in the United States, that is orchestrated elections by billionaires, so it has to result to repression, massive repression. Hitler's war killed 27 million Russians and an equal number of people around the world, 100 million. That was a capitalist war orchestrated by Hitler on behalf of the giant corporations in that country, many of which were working in collaboration and still dealing during the war with American corporations. It was another effort to redivide the world, redivide the colonies, redivide the continents. Fascism is another political form of capitalist rule. It's a form of minority rule. Socialism, the socialism that I've fought for a lifetime, is based on the simple proposition that the vast majority of humanity should run society democratically in their own interest for human needs, not capitalist profit. That the wealth that working people produce should be democratically planned and orchestrated in order to build another world. Today, young people are more interested in socialism than any time in the modern era. A majority say that they prefer socialism over capitalism. And what do they mean by that? They believe that the evils that young people are so well aware of, racism, poverty, gender discrimination, all types of discrimination, global warming, pandemics, endless wars, union busting, are not accidents that can be remedied by the election of this or that party, but rather are inherent in the system of capitalism itself. And that system has to be changed. And the youth are going to be in the forefront. Young people, young working people who want a better life, who don't want to die of plagues like COVID. And by the way, the United States, the richest nation on earth, has the largest number and percentage of COVID dead in the entire world. 1.2 million people in an advanced civilization. What a horror.
You know, Jeff, picking up on that point, you've been fighting for, well, for a more just, equitable world, more peaceful world for decades now. You're not a young man. And there has been some good news, and you've just pointed out the young people in America, for example, indicating their preference for a socialist country rather than a capitalist one. So as you now look ahead, given your vast experience over these past decades, are you hopeful? Are you still hopeful that what you've been working for may indeed finally come to pass here in the United States?
You know, I'm more hopeful than ever, even though, admittedly, it is a very dark time for the socialist movement. It's a contradiction. On the one hand, you have angry working people who are being negatively affected by every aspect of capitalist society. They're losing their homes. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their bills. They can't pay their electricity. Their education is beyond, college education is beyond most people. So they're very angry, and yet they are momentarily, in my opinion, passive. If I were to review to you the state of most of the socialist groups in the United States, and there are many and varied and with important differences, we're at a low point. And that is that the generation that has radicalized during the Vietnam War and civil rights movement, that most people my age, and I'm going on 83 in April, participated in, those movements are long past. But I think we are going to see the kind of spontaneous developments, but with a serious leadership, that we saw 2 years ago. Out of nowhere, with the murder of George Floyd, 25 million people mobilized in some 3,000 U.S. cities, mostly black and white together, an amazing phenomena. Led by blacks, they challenged systemic racism, a racism that they believe goes to the marrow of the system itself. Those are the future, those young people, those mobilizations. And we're beginning to see working people do the same thing, beginning to resume organizing independent unions, beginning to fight the boss class and understand that the boss is not their friend anymore. I think that the working people in the United States are going to give a world-class accounting of themselves. They're not going to sit by as the environment is destroyed, as our cities burn, as thousands of people die from heat prostration around the world, as the United States produces more fossil fuel rather than less, and takes no significant steps towards ending climate disaster, which is rapidly coming. So I think what we're going to see is a new leadership emerging from young people, from working people, a leadership that understands that the issues of civil liberties and democratic rights and freeing journalists like WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who exposed U.S. war crimes, or political prisoners who are emblematic of the horror of the prison industrial complex like Mumia Abu-Jamal, all of these issues are united. They support democratic rights for oppressed people around the world, including Palestinians. So the struggle for freedom of political prisoners, indeed, if I may say, all prisoners, the first thing serious revolutionaries do everywhere on earth is free the prisons. That's what happened in the French Revolution of 1789, in the Russian Revolution, and every other progressive social movement. They took the people that the ruling class considered alien to their system, and they put them in jails. The United States is number one in the world in the number and percentage of its people in prison. Millions of people, the majority black and Latino, are in U.S. prisons. If for no other reason, that the average wage of a prisoner in the United States is 50 cents an hour. For Pete's sake, why hire an immigrant for a minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, when you can have a virtual slave in an American privatized prison for 50 cents working for Fortune 500 companies. So I'm optimistic that a new leadership will emerge from these struggles. We're beginning to see the outlines of it. We will see a reconstruction of a fantastic, united socialist movement that fights for humanity's best interests and the liberation of humanity around the world from the imperialist club of the United States.
Thank you, Jeff Mackler. Thank you very much. Jeff, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time, and I wanted to ask you if you would please just take a moment and tell people how they can follow your work and the work of the organizations that you are active in.
Well, I'm the National Secretary of Socialist Action, so you can go online and see our website at socialistaction.org and get involved, make a contribution, join. Get involved in the struggles. We're active in the struggle to free Mumia and Julian Assange for civil liberties, democratic rights, abortion rights, anti-war struggles, climate mobilizations, every struggle where humanity reaches out to improve their lives and the lives of all working people. That's our cup of tea. That's what we do every day of the week, and we will make gains provided we can inspire working people to stand up against the current horrors of a system that has nothing but evil in its very bones. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to be with you. Check us out, socialistaction.org.
Jeff Mackler, thank you, my friend. Thank you very much for being with us on Law and Disorder today. Your message is always as a hopeful and inspiring one. I thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.